Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Linda Palacio. I am starting my fall season today on A Taste of the Past, and hopefully you've been a listener to past episodes. I hope you continue listening and hope that you will consider, if you haven't already, becoming a member of heritageradionetwork.org. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And I'm sure if you are like most of us, when you go shopping at the supermarket, you are looking perhaps for chicken for dinner, because we have chicken at least once a week, I'm sure, right? And what do you look for? The biggest, plumpest package of chicken? Did you ever consider what might be in the plump chicken? Well, we've heard, of course, unless you've been living under a rock, you've been hearing a lot about hormones and antibiotics and the reason to buy sustainably raised chickens and organic chickens. But there's so much more that goes on in those chickens and other foods, too, that we really were never aware of. And how did chicken come to be in a package anyway? My guest today will explain all that and a few other things that perhaps you didn't bargain for. She is Maren McKenna. And Maren is an award-winning journalist and author who specializes in public health, global health, and food policy. She's a contributor to National Geographic, where she also helped launch the award-winning food site, The Plate, and a senior fellow at Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. She's one of the stars of the 2014 documentary, Resistance, and her 2015 TED Talk, What Do We Do When Antibiotics Don't Work Anymore? That was her TED Talk. That was the title of her TED Talk. And that kind of should be the title of today's show. Maren's newest book is Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. And it's not her first book on science and disease and medicines. She has two previous books, Superbug and Beating Back the Devil, both of which won top journalist and scientific awards. Her piece on Modern Farmer, for the modern farmer on Beyond Organic Farm White Oak Pastures, received a first place award from the Association of Food Journalists. And I mention that in particular because White Oak Pastures was one of our first sponsors here at Heritage Radio Network. Welcome, Maren. This book had me staying up all night, actually.
Thank you for having me.
One, because I couldn't put it down. Number two, because it kind of gave me the creeps from time to time. But as one of our good friends and often a guest here mentioned in a blurb about the book, if you think raising farm animals on antibiotics is nothing to worry about, Big Chicken will change your mind in a hurry. That's Marion Nessel who said that. So tell us, chicken. I mean, chicken is chicken, right?
So the story of Big Chicken is actually the story of how chickens, the animals, became chicken, the commodity. And it's my contention, and I think my research proves, that the reason that happened fundamentally is our use of antibiotics. This is really the story of how we came to give antibiotics routinely to most of the meat animals on the planet, and how we discovered that was a terrible idea.
Chicken, I mean, chickens, the little chickens, originally were basically raised to lay eggs.
Right. And, if you think about probably our grandparents' time, I mean, maybe not here in New York City, but maybe even actually here, chickens would have been a thing that were out the back door. And they were there primarily to provide eggs. And for the most part, they were only eaten, at least the hens were only eaten, after they'd kind of reached the end of their useful mm-hmm. life. So 2 or 3 years of running around and chasing after chicks, and they would have been kind of old and stringy. And
the stew hens.
Right, stew hens, exactly. Right. Spent hens, as they call them in the commodity markets. And the alternative to that was what we used to call spring chickens, which were the extra roosters that were hatched out and weren't really needed for egg production because you only need at most one rooster in a flock. And so they would be fattened up and sold as delicious, very young chickens. But the amazing thing about that history that is sort of embedded in what I just described that I think we don't think about is that when chickens were a backyard phenomenon, they were the province of women.
Yeah,
they belonged to women who not only cooked the chickens but collected the eggs, and took them and sold them. They were the source of that grandmotherly phrase, butter and egg money.
That's right.
And then innovation happens and technology happens, and the chickens that were the province of women become chicken, the province of agricultural technology, which is primarily created by men. So there's a gendered aspect to this story, as well as a technology aspect and an animal welfare aspect. And all of these dimensions of this story are what drew me into trying to tell the story of chicken and the story of antibiotics, which are really the same story.
And it really is kind of a chicken and the egg kind of story, to use that old pun. But it was accidental how chickens became initially how they became a commodity. First by the woman who accidentally received too many chickens.
Right, right, right. So the person who poultry history says is the generator of the modern chicken industry is a woman named Cecilia Steele, Mrs. Wilmer Steele, who lived in on the coast of Delaware and was married to a Coast Guard officer. And she had an egg business. And one day someone made a mistake in shipping her new chicks to grow up into hens to lay eggs. And she got 10 times as many as she expected. And not really needing to raise that many eggs, she decided to just fatten the hens and sell them in the way that they would previously have sold excess roosters.
Mm-hmm.
And she did so well that all of her neighbors in the Delmarva Peninsula noticed. And Delmarva, which had been kind of the truck farming capital of the East Coast because it's very low and very fertile, very humid and moist, but very subject to weather and to the disruptions of weather and to storms that can ruin produce, Delmarva became the first chicken capital of the United States. Right. It didn't get to keep that title for very long because World War II came along, Delmarva being a place that has only a few roads in and out and was producing a lot of chicken, turned out to be very attractive to the armed forces who needed a regular source of chicken. And they essentially they grabbed hold of chicken production in Delmarva. And that opened the door for Georgia, where I live. I live in Atlanta, to slide in under Delmarva and become, as it remains, the capital of the modern chicken industry. The state of Georgia, if it were an independent country, grows as many chickens as it would be up there with China or Brazil.
Wow.
1.4 billion chickens a year come out of Georgia.
Well, it was not an easy trick getting the consumers to continue buying so many chickens. I mean, the chicken industry took off, obviously, after that. People got this special... It used to be a special treat. A roast chicken in the oven was, not
right.
Your
Sunday
usual...
Sunday lunch or Sunday dinner.
It was a Sunday
exactly.
dinner. Right, exactly. And then all of a sudden it became, as you said, a commodity meat. Now we go to the supermarket, we have chicken. Probably every family has chicken probably at least once a week.
Much more than that.
Or more than that.
The average across all the population of the United States is that we eat 90 pounds of chicken per person per year. That's about twice as much beef.
Wow.
And it's been ahead of beef since the 1970s. So that's, if you do the math roughly, that's about 4 ounces of chicken per person per day. So we are eating, chicken is literally our daily diet in the United States, much more than any other meat.
Well, they wanted to make they big chicken, big pharma, big hag. They wanted to make chickens more attractive to producers. One chicken was really, as you mentioned in your book, one chicken was really not enough for a family of four or six. And yet one chicken was too much for just a couple, two people without children. So they decided they'd get these chickens out faster and bigger and quicker. What happened then?
There's a really interesting sort of almost like a wave form in the history of chicken, which is that from the 1920s, supply keeps getting in front of demand. And then the industry had to come up with ways to stimulate demand for chicken. So back in the 1920s, people figure out how to synthesize vitamins, which means that birds can now be kept over the winter in enclosed sheds, whereas before, once they were deprived of sunlight and of scratching around in the grass and in insects, they would get very sickly and die. Mm-hmm. After vitamins are added to the feed, then there's this discovery that if you give microdoses of antibiotics to chicken, they will fatten up and grow more quickly. And from that comes the recognition that you can cram lots and lots of animals into barns and feedlots when this gets to cattle and other size barns when it gets to pigs, and produce them at a great rate of speed. All of that means that periodically there has been way more chicken than people knew what to do with. And so we really owe the way we eat chicken these days, that 4 ounces a day, mostly not in the form of a roast chicken that you are carving up at the table, but in chicken nuggets and all kinds of other further processed chicken. We owe that to a little known professor at Cornell named Robert Baker, who in the 1960s was instructed to find ways to increase the market for chicken. And he went into a basement laboratory that Cornell gave him, and he came up with all the things that I think we now think of when we walk into a supermarket and see chicken cold cuts, chicken franks, chicken bologna, chicken ham, things like that, and his signature invention, what he called the chicken stick, that we now know as the chicken nugget.
When I grew up, we called it city chicken because it was chicken on a stick, and it was the ground up chicken. Well, basically he was using the meat that was left over from carcasses from other production.
Right. He kind of copied the idea of the fish stick,
right,
which was a World War II invention. But fish sticks, if you look at them carefully, are actually sawed out of intact muscle. Well, the whole problem with chickens was that there wasn't all that much intact muscle on a bird, even though chickens, because of both antibiotics and precision nutrition and altered genetics, were getting fatter and fatter and fatter. If you were to carve the equivalent of fish sticks out of the breast of a chicken, you'd only get a couple. And Baker was the son of Depression-era farm family, and he hated waste. And so he figured out the way to... He figured out what we now call automatic deboning to get all the flesh off the carcass. And he packed all that extra flesh into these things he was thinking up. And so that's how we got the, what I think the technical term is, comminuted meat in a chicken nugget today, which is both chunks of muscle and also much more finely chopped.
Compressed and chopped meat, yeah. Of course, McDonald's didn't get their hands on that until... When did they first come out with the McNugget?
I believe it's early 1980 is the McNugget, right? Yeah. Which gets its impetus. Now, no one can prove absolutely for sure that that the McNugget was inspired by Baker, but the people at Cornell believe that all of his stuff was published for free because Cornell is a public university, and it went into the archives of every food service and food production company in the country. And at some point, someone probably pulled that out of the archives and said, oh, look what we could do with this. But the other thing that gave McNuggets their impetus, and also is really important to the story of chicken, is that in 1977, we got the first dietary guidelines for Americans from the federal government, which recommended that Americans eat less saturated fat. It was kind of the start of that war against fat that we've been locked in ever since. And that was immediately interpreted as an instruction to eat less red meat. And chicken was the obvious answer. And that's what started us on the extraordinary wave of chicken consumption, especially the boneless breast that we're still kind of locked in today.
So in order to raise those plump breasts that people would want to buy and would serve, you know, would make the entire dinner, had to fatten them up. Now, antibiotics, you said this, they started put the antibiotics in the feed started, that was quite early.
The first and it was a little bit in 1948.
Yeah. Was it 1948? 1948. The
Areomycin? Right. So, to put this in context, we don't think of this, I think, because we were all born within the antibiotic era, but the antibiotic era isn't really very old. The antibiotic era really starts in 1928 when Alexander Fleming notices that something is killing the dishes of bacteria that he has in his laboratory in London. Something's blown in the window, and that something turns out to be penicillium mold, which excretes natural penicillin. But the drugs that start the antibiotic era, including penicillin, all arrive between about 1944 and 1948. Mm-hmm. And one of those is a drug that its manufacturer called Oreomycin, but the generic name is chlortetracycline, and it was the first of the tetracycline class of drugs. And that's where this whole practice of giving antibiotics to meat animals traces back to, is that the manufacturers of Oreomycin, or chlortetracycline, which was a company called Letterly Laboratories, just outside New York City, wanted to find another market for their new drug. So almost immediately after it was patented for human use, their chemists trial using tiny doses of antibiotic contained in essentially the manufacturing waste that they're going to throw away anyway. They trial it in chicks, along with a bunch of other supplements.
Just mix it in with their feed, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And the chicks that get the Oreomycin residue gain 3 times the weight of any other chick. And within 5 years, farmers in the United States are giving 500,000 pounds of antibiotics a year to their livestock. It takes off so fast.
Well, we can only think about that going then into our system. Although the connection between why they were growing so much bigger, so much faster, is still kind of a little bit of a mystery. Obviously, chicks get, as you said, they get diseases. They die off, particularly in the winter. It's not like you're going to take antibiotics and get big. But they obviously were fighting, in normal cases, probably fighting off other diseases that were stunting their growth a bit.
So this is subtle. So if you think about everything we've heard lately in the past couple of years about the microbiome, about the way that we live in a microbial world that coats everything in our surroundings and coats us and also is inside us, you know, that our guts are the home to populations of bacteria that vastly outnumber the actual cells in our bodies. What growth promoter antibiotics, as they came to be called, what they really do is that they're given to animals in feed and water, tiny doses, much smaller than would cure an infection. And they perturb the gut microbiome. They change the mix of bacteria that live in the animal's guts in such a way that they affect how nutrition is taken up out of the animal's feed. And so it very quickly became a practice that farmers could either grow animals to the same weight faster using less feed, or they could spend less money on feed and get animals to the same weight, or they could grow them to faster and get them turn more cycles of animals through their barns. It was a practice that seemed to have no downside.
Yeah.
It used things that the antibiotic industry wasn't at first really planning on using. It benefited farmers. It expanded the meat economy. It took a decade or two before people realized that this really did have a downside that no one had predicted, which was that using antibiotics in animals in that manner created antibiotic-resistant bacteria that didn't stay with the animals but moved out into the environment and eventually moved to people who had no connection with farming and threatened human health.
Well, it is. I mean, it certainly had that upside initially. I mean, I think you mentioned in the book a statistic that by 1954, 1 billion chickens went to market. You're looking at me like you don't remember that one. Maybe you.
there are a lot of numbers in my book.
I'm sure it was, you know, something I picked out of, you know, one of the chapters.
Well, so but, I mean, today in the United States, we produce almost 9 billion broiler chickens a year.
But that's then, ridiculous. When it was still new, it was that was something new.
It was very, very fast.
But you mentioned that there were these other created resistant bacteria that lived outside of the chickens. The chickens were okay, but lived outside of the chickens.
Right. So what happens is, as you know, we all have these communities of bacteria in our guts. Every living thing does, and the antibiotics that were given to the animals in their feed and water go into their guts, affect the bacteria there, and then one of two things happens: either those animals go to the slaughterhouse and we disassemble them to make them into meat. And in the process of doing that, the contents of their guts gets on the meat. So those resistant bacteria are on the meat as it goes into packaging, as we carry it home to our home kitchens or to restaurant kitchens. And now, if we all ran our home kitchens like microbiology labs and sloshed bleach everywhere and cooked things until they were carbonized black, we probably wouldn't be at that much risk, but of course no one does that, right? And so you might contaminate your hands or a counter or a cutting board or a knife or cooking utensils, and so those bacteria enter our home environments or the environment of a restaurant kitchen. The other thing that happens is that while the animals are still living, those resistant bacteria in their guts exit their guts with their manure, right, and then might end up in a manure lagoon if it's a pig farm, or in the heap of manure litter that gets raked out of a chicken house, as they're called. And then the bacteria pass into storm runoff, into groundwater. They blow away with dust on the wind. They may contaminate the clothing or the skin of farm workers. They may contaminate the local environment around farms. There's really good research now in places that have heavy chicken raising, such as North Carolina, for instance, that living near industrial-scale farms puts you at higher risk for contracting an antibiotic-resistant infection, even if you have no contact with that farm at all.
I was reading even, like, driving behind a poultry truck.
A chicken truck, yes. Which I have to say I have done a lot in the past couple of years. I don't particularly recommend it. But I have been, you know, in Delmarva and in Georgia and in North Carolina and gone in search of chicken trucks. And they leave a very, in addition to the dust blowing off them and the very unhappy looking chickens on them, they leave a very distinctive signature, which is a kind of a sort of surf of discarded feathers along the side of the road. Mm-hmm. It looks at first like it's snowed. Hmm. And that's how you know that the trucks have gone by.
Wow. a couple incidents happened that raised people's awareness and eyebrows, aside from scientists saying, maybe this isn't so good. But suddenly there were outbreaks of disease. Yes, there were salmonella cases before, but not to the extent, well, the one that you open the book with, I have to say, it's a lot of scientific information, but you're a very good storyteller. So it makes
Thank
this
you.
Information so easy to read.
That's because
I couldn't
I'm
put
so
it down.
I'm so happy to hear that. Thanks.
it really does flow. And the story that you open with, of course, is a salmonella outbreak, which is later. So we have to get back to what was making this strain of salmonella so resistant.
So
that's something that you've sort of uncovered.
The outbreak that you're describing is the outbreak that starts the book is an outbreak of antibiotic-resistant salmonella that occurred from 2013 to 2014, was investigated by the Centers for Disease Control, and was tracked back to one single very large chicken processing company that kind of dominates the trade in the West Coast, which is a company called Foster Farms. More than 600 victims were identified in that outbreak in 30 states and territories. And the CDC estimates that the multiplier of diagnosed cases in a foodborne outbreak versus cases that of people who never go to the doctor or never get the appropriate test done can be more than 1 in 30, which means that there were probably thousands of victims of this outbreak. And I tell the story of this one particular guy who was a victim of this outbreak who had a very unusual set of symptoms, not the usual sort of gut distress, but a profound disruption of his circulatory system by inflammation, which caused him to almost lose a leg. I tell that story in the start of the book, not so much because this outbreak was exceptional, but because it was not. It happens to be a very well-researched outbreak, but it's an example of things that happen in the United States and around the world every day, because by adding antibiotics to food production and not keeping track of the consequences, we have put ourselves at risk of peril like this, mm-hmm. both in large identified outbreaks and in individual cases of foodborne illness that never get diagnosed. And one of the consequences of our learning to give antibiotics to animals, not just for growth promotion, but to protect them against the diseases that occur as we crowded them together, is that outbreaks of illness, as food production became both more consolidated and shipped its products over longer distances, those outbreaks have become very separate in space and in time from the places that cause the outbreak. And it makes it much more difficult to actually track the trail of evidence back. Mm. So this poor guy, Rick Schiller, who has somewhat recovered from his experience, you know, almost lost his leg, has been left with arthritis and with circulatory problems and with diverticulitis and a bunch of other things, you know, from this illness 4 years ago now. He happened to have a very well-documented case that also had been part of a lawsuit, and so I felt like his documentation was very solid. But he is emblematic of thousands and thousands of people that are victims of this push to increase productivity by means of antibiotics that we brought into meat production because of chicken.
All right. We're going to continue this discussion because there's a lot more interesting information when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts of the seed, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The endosperm is the main energy storage unit of the seed. That's where the growing plant gets its energy before it can start photosynthesizing and making its own. It makes up a huge portion of the grain, about 83%, and it's the main source that's used for white flour. When you make white flour, you get rid of the germ and the bran and just have the white endosperm left. It contains almost all the carbohydrates. It also contains protein and iron and some of the other B vitamins as well. It's kind of what you classically think of when you're thinking of flour. So all that's there when you're milling with whole grains. But when you mill with whole grains, you also get the bran, which is the kind of roughage and gives that kind of color to it. Also gives you extra fiber that helps you to be regular. And you also get the germ, which adds the fat and the flavor, which we all like from whole grains. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Maren McKenna, and she's the author of Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. And Maren, we were talking about people realizing that perhaps all this use of antibiotics might not be a good thing, because doctors and physicians all knew that Fleming, even when he first produced the penicillin antibiotic, warned that, you know, don't overuse it. It could desensitize the certain strains of bacteria to the effectiveness of the fighting action of the antibiotic. It's interesting because then antibiotics were available over the counter, which was, you know, I think they still might be in several countries.
But in some parts of the world.
Yeah, in some parts of the world. But what it wasn't until quite late that maybe mid-50s, that penicillin was by prescription only.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look at the very early history of antibiotics, which, you know, in the first few years are only medical uses, and then agricultural use comes in when the FDA approves it and gives a license to it in 1951. There was so much enthusiasm for antibiotics. And I guess, you know, that makes sense in retrospect because, they used to call antibiotics miracle drugs. Mm-hmm. And they really were. I mean, people used to die horrible deaths of fulminant infections. My own great uncle, actually, who was a fireman in Manhattan, in 1938, he was sort of scratched and bumped on a day off in the firehouse. And he, within the course of a week, he developed septic shock. And died of it, a really horrible lingering death that was written up in what was then the daily newspaper in the Rockaways where his parents were. And it was 3 years before the first human test of penicillin, which was done in a guy who was incredibly ill, a British constable, from having scratched his face on a rosebush thorn in his garden. I mean, it's really hard to understand, I think, for those of us born within the antibiotic era, how incredibly vulnerable to infection we used to be. And well, so when antibiotics arrived...
Right, majority of war deaths were
exactly.
due
and
to
the,
infection.
And that's what, you know, the push to make penicillin from an accidental discovery into a drug was partly because of the advance of World War II. It really doesn't get developed until 1940. And the Alexander Fleming's collaborators actually smuggle it to America because England by 1940 is already involved in the war, whereas we aren't yet. And the funny thing is, though, you know, right at the beginning, in the midst of that crazy enthusiasm for antibiotics, as you say, people were just kind of tossing it into everything. I mean, it was in mouthwash, it was in lipstick, it was in, you know, throat lozenges. You could buy it over the counter. And yet Fleming, before any of that happened, in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 1945, he said, we should be careful. We should use these conservatively. If we don't, then bacteria will become resistant and these drugs will lose their power. And no one listened
to him. Well, and another scientist even later, Marie Coates.
Oh, so she is one of the lost heroines of this story.
She warned about that, about right. the overuse as well in 1962.
Specifically in agriculture,
yeah.
yes.
Now, specifically for agriculture. Because just prior to that, something else had been done with antibiotics. It wasn't putting it in the feed, but it was in processing when it was getting packaged and ready to go to market.
Tell us about this story. So this is what I believe to be a truly lost episode that I seem to have accidentally uncovered. So this is the story of...
Another hero, CNN, the antibiotic search, okay.
This is the story of acronizing. And the company that is responsible for the start of growth promoter antibiotics, Letterly Laboratories, part of American Cyanamid, a big, you know, sort of post-war corporation, they are responsible for this as well. Looking for another market for their drug, they came up with the idea that after animals were already being given antibiotics for as growth promoters and to protect them against the conditions of farming, Letterly Laboratories has the idea to persuade meat and fish processors, so slaughterhouses and mm-hmm. packaging houses, to dip raw chicken and fish into solutions of antibiotics and then to package them for sale with the raw antibiotic, the active antibiotic still clinging
just
to the
sort of
flesh.
On the skin. I think the listeners have to understand that prior to the late 50s or 60s, chicken was sold whole. It wasn't unless you bought it from a butcher and said, please quarter it or cut
right,
it into
exactly.
pieces. Chicken was sold whole. It wasn't packaged into individual pieces. Although I remember my mother buying it in mid-50s, probably. Probably must have been late 50s.
So I think if you went to a bespoke butcher, you know, there are so many other things that are going on in the 50s, in the post-war years. You know, there's the rise in much more meat consumption. There's also a change in retail, right? So that before, you know, before the late 1940s, we don't really have the big supermarket
right.
chains in the same
right.
way that we do now. We had a few, like the A&P, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, you know, goes back, I think, to the beginning of the 20th century. But for the most part, supermarkets were a relatively local thing.
Right.
So you might have a local smaller supermarket that had in it a butcher, and they might get in chickens, and they might cut them up for you. But that sense that the chicken is a thing of disassembled parts that arrives at the market already completely wrapped up
in a plastic package
in styrofoam trays. Some people in the industry actually call it styrofoam chicken. They're talking about the package, not about the flesh. Anyway, to get back to acronizing. So the idea behind acronizing, as in so many of the other things in this story, is sort of it's an example of failing to anticipate unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So they think that if they dip this raw meat and fish in active antibiotic, they will be killing or at least retarding the growth of spoilage bacteria.
Yeah.
And so it will be able to persist on the shelf in a cold case for weeks instead of days, which, you know, when I tell people the story, everyone makes exactly the expression that you just made. There's this sort of instinctive ick to it. And it's yet another example of sort of like how science gets out in front of what would be a reasonable consumer expectation. So,
where did the name come from? Acronize.
So there are very few records left. Letterly did have a drug called acromycin. But it was not the drug they were using for acronizing. What they were using for acronizing was oreomycin, chlorotetracycline. My intuition is that if you take the etymology of acronizing apart, kron is the Greek, I think, for time. And a is a prefix that indicates canceling or negativity. So I think they meant that a thing that
long,
is acronized
long shelf life.
Is a thing that is timeless, yeah. that has been taken out of time.
All right. Well, you couldn't find records of this in
it's
the
true.
FDA,
so
right?
I stumbled across this. I was reading all these old science journal articles from the 50s and the 40s, and I stumbled across a reference to one in a list of footnotes or citations. And it was titled, Antibiotics in Food Preservation. And I thought, that's a little odd, because mm-hmm. what I've been reading about up to this point is food production. Food preservation is something different. So I went in search of this paper, and I couldn't find it anywhere. It wasn't in any of the digitized banks of science journal articles. And I eventually tracked it down via a seller of old books, an online seller of old books. And it turned out to be a paper that had been presented at a conference in 1962 at what was called the University of Nottingham Easter School in Agricultural Sciences, which was a conference that happened every couple of years in England. And I
didn't get a lot of play in the New
did
York
not.
Times.
Yes, right? Exactly. No play at all in the New York Times. And the conference proceedings, the collected papers arrived, beautifully packaged up in leather bound. And I opened it up and there were all these papers to antibiotics in preserving meat, antibiotics in preserving fish, antibiotics in preserving chicken, antibiotics allowing you to ship meat into the center of South America where there are only a few trains, and my mind was blown. Mm. And so from there I turned to old databases of newspapers to see if anyone had written about it. And I found acronizing, this process, mentioned over and over again in grocery store advertisements. So in the kind of pen and ink art ads that grocery stores used to run in local papers that would say things like, you know, ham on special this week, mm-hmm. and we have pineapples today, and the mandarin oranges have arrived. There would be a little note on the bottom, our chicken is acronized.
Don't buy your chicken unless it's acronized.
The company, yes, right. It turned out, after I did some more digging, the company had actually done what even today we would recognize as a very smart media strategy. They had they hired a Madison Avenue advertising firm. And they had gone to food editors around the country and tried to convince them that acronizing was this fantastic, modern, you know, looking forward kind of thing that was going to make food safe and shiny. And eventually this advertising campaign put together big, gorgeous four-color ads for magazines with gorgeous bronzed chickens in them. And they never mention antibiotics. They say things like, acronized chicken is fresh and
so we have
sweet.
No idea what this process
exactly.
is. And then a very unfortunate incident occurred, and there was an outbreak of
right. So there was a mysterious outbreak
disease, just sores and
of staph bacteria yeah. in slaughterhouse workers in Seattle in the late 1950s. That was solved by one of the first disease detectives of the CDC in their CDC disease detective corps, which began in 1951, and he traced it back to the use of acronizing, this antibiotic dip, in one particular slaughterhouse, and further back to the chickens that were being sent to the slaughterhouse, which had all been dosed with antibiotics. And those two together, those extra doses of antibiotics, had created a superbug that was infecting the arms and hands of the slaughterhouse workers. But I have to say that, I mean, that outbreak, that alerted, I think alerted medicine that something was going on. But it wasn't that outbreak that shut acronizing down.
Wow.
What really shut it down was that by the mid-1960s, consumers, everyday shoppers, are beginning to be suspicious of additives of all kinds in their food.
Right.
And they just generally slowly persuade. You can actually see it in like letters to the editor in some regional newspapers. People are writing in saying, we don't understand what's going on with our chicken anymore. We are suspicious of how long this acronized chicken has been in the store. And by the late 1960s, the FDA has withdrawn the license and acronizing vanishes into history.
All right. So they actually outlawed it? I mean, did the FDA withdrew the package
license that they had granted. Yeah.
But antibiotic use within the feed before chickens are slaughtered, that's still around.
Right. So the FDA actually attempts to reverse that in 1977. An activist new FDA commissioner, one of the reformers brought in by the Carter administration, tries to shut down antibiotic use in feed and water for farm animals and is prevented by political interference.
Big business.
A congressman with big agricultural connections threatens him and says that if he attempts to hold the hearings that will expose that this is causing antibiotic resistance and is not safe, this congressman says to the White House, he will hold the FDA's entire budget hostage.
Wow.
And the Carter White House, which has a lot of reforms on its plate, tells its new FDA commissioner to let the subject go.
But in all fairness now to everybody who's listening, a lot of the big industry, and particularly, like, we think of Purdue right away, they took this responsibility upon themselves and altered the use
what happened in the past couple of years is really interesting. I mean, when I first started writing this book 4 years ago, I thought it was going to be sort of an expose about how there's been this problem and everyone has known it's a problem and no one has moved to change it. And as I was writing the book, things actually started to change. So it turned from an expose to a sort of chronicle of cultural change.
Well, then we can talk about how it was used in other things, beef and milk, mm-hmm. in the cows, mm-hmm. In the milking machines through industrialization. So in part, we can blame it on the industrialization of agriculture as well.
Right. Well, I think that antibiotics in some way create industrialization because they're the thing that makes it possible to increase the concentration of animals and yet keep them safe, to move animals through faster in a more high throughput fashion. I think all the things that we now critique about industrial scale farming really trace back to antibiotics, to treating animals sort of as widgets instead of as beings, to moving them through very rapidly, to making things very consistent and very safe, but, you know, kind of forgetting about flavor and forgetting about animal welfare.
And everyone's very, very observant, I think, when they go to the markets now and buying milks and make sure that there's no additives, nothing, hormones or antibiotics. Although you can't trace some of those. But taste, you said flavor. What about, this first drove you to set up and take note to chickens, too, being in France, you mentioned. What about taste? What has this altered the taste of our chickens? Now, I will tell you, too, anyone who goes and buys, it'll be a lot more expensive, but, an organic, sustainably raised chicken. Mm-hmm. You're going to pay a lot more money, but you are going to notice a difference.
So the book begins and ends with scenes of me stuffing my face with delicious chicken. And those scenes are there for a reason. The opening scene is in
Paris. Yes, she does eat chicken.
I do, in fact, eat chicken. And that's part of the point, is that I wanted to make the point that you can closely interrogate meat production and be an active critic of meat production as it's conducted now and still want to eat meat. No disrespect to my friends and to animal advocates who are vegan, that I have great respect for vegans, but I don't think that we have to stop growing meat. I don't think we have to stop growing meat animals to solve the problems of meat production. I think we can solve the problems of meat production and still have meat to eat. But what this encounter that I had with this chicken in Paris, I guess this is sort of a cliche that, you know, people go to Paris and they eat something delicious and their eyes and their taste buds are opened to the reality of how food is different in the rest of the world. But it started me thinking that what we elevated in the United States when we decided to industrialize to such an extent is we elevated consistency and efficiency and reliability. So chickens are always going to taste the same, even if they don't taste like much. They're always going to be the same size. They're always going to be the same sort of color of flesh. But we kind of forgot about flavor.
Flavor, right.
And it's really, I think it's, you know, flavor, we are designed evolutionarily to seek out flavor because flavor indicates nutrition to us, and as well as being a source of pleasure in its own right. And for us to have somehow created a meat production system that forgot about flavor was something that I thought was really worth taking a look at. And though antibiotics don't make meat flavorless, antibiotics created the conditions in which we came to grow meat without regard to what it tasted like. And so that, to me, was worth looking at as well.
Well, it is indeed an eye-opener in many ways. And and we've come, you know, it's funny, I say we've come a long way. But yes and no, I mean, we came from the early days of, you know, so then all of a sudden mass producing and producing lots of chicken for everybody. And now we're scaling back again and saying, let's go for quality and not quantity. And hopefully we're in a good place once again.
I think
we
are in a better place. And what makes me think that is that just in the past couple of years, almost every company that produces chicken is ahead of the other proteins in this, has started an antibiotic-free line. They've really started to understand that this is what consumers want. And what the tasks in front of us now are to convince cattle and pigs to go in the same direction and to convince the developing world that really needs its protein as its populations expand, that they shouldn't make the same mistakes that we in the industrialized West made.
All right. So should you pick up that package and wonder about what's inside of it? And should you be worried? Well, take a look at Marin's book, and you might think twice. It's Marin McKenna, and the book is Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. Marin, thank you so much. There's so much more information about this, and we know from following good practices in farming and sustainability and food in our world, that these are all very important topics.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.